Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Curaçao podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me for the second episode in a row in a while is Joel.
What is this? I was supposed to get a prestigious position on a good podcast. I mean, where is Mark Maron? Where is this American Life people? What is this little low budget thing? You know what? I refuse to record at all.
All right, mm-hmm. You do you. I'll introduce the other guest, all right?
I don't care. No, we're just kidding.
Yes, I know. With us again is Chris Funderburg from The Pink Smoke and the one-year anniversary episode on some movie called High and Low. That might be a namesake of the podcast. Who knows? And also with us is John Cribbs, who he and Chris are the founders of The Pink Smoke, a very good film site about film, and they are very good professionals, and I like to have professionals on here.
Thank you very much for having us. This is Christopher Funderburg speaking, so you can recognize my voice and associate it.
And this is John Cribbs. Thank you, sir, for the kind words.
You're welcome. So, before I firstly start, I don't think I asked Chris this before, but What are you guys' first exposure to Kurosawa, if you can even, place it?
I definitely remember. It was Hidden Fortress was my first one, and it was definitely because I read that it inspired Star Wars. You know, Star Wars being, the first film I ever saw in the theater. And
being a big then part you of saw my, it, you were like, this is life. Just like Star Wars.
And it did not disappoint. Space battles, bounty hunters, everything.
Space ghosts.
No, I was blown away by it. I thought it was amazing. And what's kind of funny is that, you know, obviously I went from there to Seven Samurai and his other films, and I really kind of got deeply immersed in Kurosawa. Hidden Fortress, I kind of threw in the back burner, that movie, I know all about it, whatever. It's not that big. Not that special.
Yeah, it's only excellent.
And then a few years later, when I was doing an article on this for the website on his 100th anniversary, I rewatched all the movies and I watched Hidden Fortress for the first time since the first time I saw it, and was like, "Holy shit, it's a masterpiece!" And I rediscovered it all over again, and it was just great, just like a great experience to kind of cycle around on that movie.
Oh yeah, it's not just great, it inspired Star Wars, which was probably the biggest franchise ever, but it's also just a great, damn near perfect, adventure movie on its own.
Absolutely.
It has my single favorite action scene, I think, where he's chasing the scouts trying to get back to the guard station.
Yeah.
And then finally, that scene is, I think that might be my single favorite, action sequence.
And that awesome long fight that just keeps going.
Oh yeah, it's wonderful. It's great.
I met just on the Hidden Fortress episode, but I remember the first time I saw it, thinking I hope they run into those tents in the background, and they totally do.
Everything's got to make way for that fight. It is truly epic. I love it.
Yeah, and Chris, what was your first exposure to
Kurosawa? Now you have me wondering, did I answer this when I did the show before, and am I going to give the same answer? It feels...
I don't think so, but I can't remember.
I honestly can't remember either. But it would have been in high school. I'm pretty sure Yojimbo was the first one I ever saw, and I think I saw it for a similar reason of hearing that this is the movie that Fistful of Dollars ripped off and got sued over, and that this is the samurai movie and it's the really good one. I know that I saw almost all of his movies in high school, and in fact, I don't think I've seen Redbeard until I watched it again for this podcast since high school. The video store I went to down there where you are in Delaware, near the University of Delaware, there was this place called Video Paradiso. Video American, it was called, and they had, it was like a college video store, even though I lived in a very rural area. I lived out in farm country, and it was like a 35-40 minute drive to the video store. they had like a Kurosawa section and a Godard section and all of that sort of thing. And so I saw all of his movies in that capacity. I saw Yojimbo and then just rented everything else they had from there. So it would have been whatever ones were sort of commonly available in the VHS era. So like Seven Samurai and Sanjuro and, you know, that sort of thing.
You're lucky. Lucky before I discovered my video Paradiso, which was Video Vault in Alexandria, Virginia.
Best video store in the world.
Yeah, I had to, you know, make do with going from like one Blockbuster to another Hollywood Video, and they'd have exactly one Kurosawa movie, every single one. And, you know, luckily it was a different one, you know, so you'd pick up Yojimbo here and High and Low there and whatnot, and just kind of amass this viewing collection that you'd finally see all of them, but never in one place until, you know, I found my home away from home in Alexandria.
I never saw High and Low until the Criterion release. That was one of the ones that I wasn't even aware of. I don't think I saw anything except for his period films until they started dribbling out on Criterion stuff. They just weren't around as much. Like, you know, like Rashomon and Hidden Fortress and Seven Samurai, those were around. Even Stray Dog, you know. But that's got to be what my experience was. I remember I watched Yojimbo with my good friend Evan Draper, who I had a zine with in high school, and we were really shocked at the level of violence in it.
All you kids with your film struck, you don't know how lucky you have it.
Yeah, kids today don't know. You can see fucking anything. You can see anything. I remember, I was just remembering the other day, I sent a handwritten letter to New Yorker asking them what Fassbender movies they owned because they had released Marriage of Maria Braun and Chinese Roulette. This is again when I'm in high school. And I was like, do you have any others? And just like a handwritten letter, just like waiting to hear back from them. Of course, they didn't send some fucking letter back to rural Pennsylvania. Like,
I'm imagining that letter written in like really pathetic, like little kid handwriting.
Subliterate.
Do you have Mother Coosters Goes to Heaven?
No, it was also because you didn't even know what they had directed. So it was like, are there other Fassbender movies? You know, like, what do you...
Did he direct two or three movies?
Yeah. Can you list some for me and send me some?
So, as mentioned at from Regent at the top, this episode is on... That's not mentioned, actually. But this episode is the first half of the 1965 pairing. It's Redbeard, which is Kurosawa's huge epic swan song with Toshiro Mifune, and this movie called An Innocent Witch by Gosho. Yeah, Gosho, not Gosha. I don't know much. I don't know about An Innocent Witch. I picked it because I never heard of the director or movie. But Redbeard, I was familiar with. I first saw it maybe 4 years ago when I first got into Kurosawa, and watching it like for a second time, I was like, "Oh, I remember everything that happens in this." It all this one that was like it came all came flying back pretty much immediately.
It's very like we're talking about not being exactly episodic, but it's based on a short story collection. So it is in kind of segments and, you know, kind of different sketches that kind of move into one another where, I mean, the most striking thing is when you watch the movie is that Mifune's not the main character. He really takes a back seat to the young doctor who becomes, you know, the main focus.
Yeah.
But even he takes a back seat later on when Otoyo becomes, you know, sort of like the central focus when the young girl that they take in. And then she takes a backseat when Chobo, the young boy, and his family become, like, a big thing. And it's kind of an interesting... It's not very like Kurosawa to kind of branch off the protagonist duties from, like, one person to another the way he does in this movie.
There's a lot about this movie, though, that's not very like Kurosawa. It's interesting. To me, this is really... It's not just a swan song with Mifune. I feel like this is the end of the era for him. You know what I mean? That, like, when I think of, like, what Kurosawa is, even though he makes good movies before and after, it's like Stray Dog to Red Beard is like, mm-hmm. when you think of what Kurosawa is, that's like the stretch. And then, you know, after this movie, he starts making color movies. He starts taking 5 years in between every film. He starts working with different actors because Mifune's gone. He starts making more artificial and stylized movies after this. And they don't have that same sort of griminess that I think, and like gritty attention to detail. Not attention to detail is the wrong phrase. Attention to like the details of verifiable reality. You know, like Kagemusha and Ran are like pageants, you know? And yeah. I think that's where he goes, and Dodesuka Den, certainly, that's where he goes after this. And so I think this is a fascinating movie, watching it again for the first time in like, you know, 25 years. To me, to see how much it's
like...
And there's
Uzala.
Yeah. How far can it go?
And there's Uzala is kind of like a documentary feel a bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree that it definitely feels there's a finality to this film, and it feels like a big wrap, an epic wrapping up of his career at that time. Another reason is that the plot kind of cycles back to Toshirô Sagata, his first film, where you're dealing with an apprentice who kind of hones his art and learns to kind of get over himself and sort of restructure his own behavior and his own opinion. And both films are kind of have the theme of, I think that Kurosawa sees medicine and the same as he does martial arts, where it's an art, where that you kind of hone your skills, where you can have theories about it, but until you are actually doing it in practice, you're actually getting out into the world and getting that experience, you're not going to grow as a person. And then these two people have older, wiser teachers that they meet, and that they get the chance to really get out there and understand why they're doing what they're doing. And it kind of becomes, it's a completely formative experience for them, where they kind of actually understand for the first time why they want to do what they do. So I kind of think that's neat that film kind of goes back and kind of harks back to that. And a lot of different films, obviously, of Kurosawa's have that same theme, but that one in particular, his first film, that's kind of has a nice cycling back effect.
You know what struck me about this one, too, that watching it this time, especially because, you know, a couple months ago we did that Imamura podcast. This movie happens in 65, which is like, in terms of Imamura, that's right in between, you know, Intentions of Murder and The Pornographers. You know, Oshima breaks through with Three Resurrected Drunkards in like 68, but he's making movies before then. Like, new Japanese cinema is like happening around Kurosawa. And what I was watching at this time, I was thinking, it's interesting how much women are the focus of this movie, because that's something that's also not a Kurosawa specialty. And that first scene where the woman is having the breakdown about why she was forced to marry her mother's lover, I thought, this is like an Imamura heroine. This is like a character out of the fucking Insect Woman. And the movie doesn't completely adopt like an Imamura, Oshima sort of point of view on these female characters. The movie, it feels to me a lot like Kurosawa's Redbeard and a bit of the Novice Doctor as well, looking at new Japanese cinema and saying, like, the world around me changed. I suddenly feel exposed to all this kind of like neuroses and murder and sexual violence. And what do I do about it? Let me sit here and look at it. There's a weird way in which it feels like him trying to contend with how cinema is changing around him, where he goes from being the radical revolutionary voice to like someone who's just having to learn about the world. And so in a funny way, it's interesting. It feels to me like the Red Beard Doctor and the young doctor are both sort of analyzing these like Imamura Oshima characters, these women who like commit murder because they've been raped too much. You know, like that's not a typical Kurosawa plot, but that's very regular for those guys, you know?
It was definitely the end of an era for Japanese cinema. I mean, Yasuhiro Ozu died the week they started production, you know?
Yeah.
Mm. So it was, yeah.
And and Mizoguchi had been dead for almost a decade, so like the old guard was pretty much dying away.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's interesting too how much, because if you think Kurosawa finally makes a Japanese woman's film, right? That he's going to do something that resembles mm-hmm. Naruse or Mizoguchi, and this movie does not. You know, it doesn't look like those movies.
It's definitely not a noble suffering movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. Mm. I'd say that's my main reaction to this, is it feels like Kurosawa understanding he's coming to the end of the road in some way, whatever that means, that like he's reached the end of whatever path he was on. And that might just be retrospective, because we know that's true when we look at his work.
Yeah. Joel, you got any... What was your reaction to this?
Well, it didn't... I was actually, since I didn't know anything about this movie, like we were joking before, I assumed it was a pirate movie, but that's what I get for falling into the beard trap. But I was very...
Did the kung fu surprise you when it showed up so late in the movie?
It did, but it also kind of made sense in a weird way that like I was enjoying that part because I was like, of course, if the doctor also knew kung fu, he would know how.
It's not. Hold on, I shouldn't be dumb. It's not kung fu. I shouldn't say that. The martial arts,
judo, man.
It's judo. Is definitely.
Yeah, I say I don't want to sound like clownish. Yeah. Sorry, that was my fault for putting us on that track. No.
Oh yeah, it's another reference back to Sanjiro.
People are already absolutely about how angry they are that you called it a kung fu. No, but
when they're doing that Asian man fighting, am I right, guys? Yeah,
it's real Steven Seagal. He made that right.
There is a Steven Seagal-esque amount of wrist breaking in it. I will say for that scene.
Yeah, bones popping through, just like above the law. So I was surprised at how you were saying, like, it seems Toshiro Mifune gets pushed to the back burner. Like, I don't even feel like he takes the center stage at basically any point in this movie. You know, he's never I'm standing above everybody and only I can fix this, you know, Dr. House, to use a bad example, kind of thing. He's very humble from the beginning.
Dr. House, those pimps.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
What? No, yeah, definitely. He's taking over the Shimura role, right? He's like the sagacious guy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah, 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 Joel, you're familiar with Shimura.
Yeah, because we write love letters back to you. What is that supposed to mean?
Oh, he looks like your dad.
I don't know the man. It just looks like my father.
Yeah, he died when you were one year old.
That.
Yes. Yeah, for like one scene.
He was like, "All you doctors are fake, right?" And he was like, and Toshiro's like, "Sure, whatever, dude."
Yeah, he also kind of gets pushed back, I think, with everybody else. You know, everyone kind of moves one step back in a way. But it was great. It's great seeing him in the movie, though. Obviously, he's just immediately have that Kurosawa connection, and you know, kind of has sort of a comforting feel just to have him there. But
and it's one of the roles few times when people push back against Redbeard in the film, so it's great to have like a screen force big enough to like hold weight against Mifune too. I think if you just put some nobody in that role, it doesn't have as big of impact
to push back against his dry insult comic behavior towards people.
Yeah, but he gets chiseled and he accepts it. He gets to fade in that scene. I agree. This is Kurosawa's funniest movie. Is that what you were trying to say, John?
It's funny. The representation of the women, though, in the movie is something that I think, if I had like a qualm with the movie, it might be that. Like, if I, you know, like that scene. I kind of don't know what to think about the scene where he calls him in to do the surgery on a woman whose intestines are coming out, and that weird, weird framing of him between her legs and that very grotesque sort of position they have her in with like three men like trying to like.
Well, that's a very Oshima shot.
Yeah,
that's like something that's completely out of an Oshima movie. That's what makes me think. A, it's super startling to see nudity in a Kurosawa movie.
That's what I thought.
But it's
like the to me the way that it was presented felt like a like symbolically it was a rape.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it reminded me of, I can't think of the title, but that classic short story where the country doctor comes to examine the little girl, and she's refusing to open her mouth, and they like hold her down and end up ripping her mouth open, and it's this like very like increasingly disturbing scene where he's trying to help her, but in you know her resisting, it becomes this eerily creepy sexual thing. Like you know, trying to take down her defenses. And I wish I could remember the title, but yeah, exactly.
Green Eggs and Ham. Green Eggs and Ham. No, I completely agree with you though. But that's also my point, where I still feel like he doesn't get. He's still like an outside looking at sort of the symptoms of the new culture, like a doctor. You know, the stuff does have a weirdly clinical, unpleasant feel frequently. Like, he's not going to turn into Nerus out of nowhere. You know what I mean? Like, that's just not going to happen to him. So he wants to engage it, but he is still outside of it in some way. The perspective of it is still firmly in the young doctor's perspective. You know, even when it moves away from the young doctor, you know, to focus on the 12-year-old girl they rescue and Chobo, it's still sort of in his world, you know, and well, I think his world as guided by Redbeard.
Well, yeah, and it's also that like she is going through sort of the same experience as he is, you know, where she has this stubborn, she's you know retracted into her shell, and she just has this very, she has this unwillingness to kind of come out and be social and kind of.
They hate the clothes they're supposed to wear.
Right, right, right.
Oh, yeah.
The Use of Force is the name of that short story. I just remembered.
Oh, okay.
The Use of Force 2, Force on Force. I'm going to... I've got my best
Use of Force Awakens.
Yeah.
I really do like this movie a lot, but at the same time, like, it... There's kind of so much to it. It's hard for me to really wrap my head around the whole 3-hour like epic that it is. In terms of, like, it's kind of like it's just a giant character piece that like that feels like you mentioned it, Chris. It's kind of clinical and a bit cold. Where like it's kind of where I'm still trying to like grapple with what exactly. It like how I feel about it still, even though I know I really like it.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. It's a movie that's hard to sort of say what it is for a lot of reasons that we've outlined, for the episodic nature, for the fact that Mifune dominates the film but is in it so little, the weird avenues it takes, but then also that it has such a simple setup. You know where it's going in the first scene. The arrogant young man who doesn't want to learn from the wise old doctor, but is going to learn from him, you know, that, you know, it's sort of hard to figure out how to bite into it. I agree with that completely.
Well, I think too, when we come into the film through the young doctor's eyes, you know, and we see, whereas, you know, we're used, of course, to, like, you know, modern amenities and, you know, the modern world. And so coming into this very meticulously constructed, you know, clinic that is just small and has these leaky confines and it just has this wretchedness of all these poor patients who come to it, I think we have this same reaction of, you know, I don't want to be here, you know. But I think that's kind of the genius of Kurosawa with this movie, is that we kind of like him. Hopefully, you know, if it works for you, you know, you kind of come into the world of this film and just appreciate it. I love that it like has a ghost scene in the middle of the movie, almost like a film, a flashback that's at least shot in the way that a lot of Japanese ghost stories are shot, and that haunting, like, bell that they hear that, you know, signals her presence every time she comes into the scene. I also, something I thought
that
I
also has
Kurosawa's
single
time.
Most romantic shot in that sequence, they see each other and all of the chimes get hit by the wind right as they notice each other.
Oh, yeah.
It's a beautiful shot. Anyway, sorry.
No, I was just going to say something I always thought I hated, but it turns out I love, is, I always thought it was like bad screenwriting, but a flashback within a flashback within a flashback. They do that. I remember John Carpenter does that in Ghost of Mars.
Yes.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
What you hated about that was the flashback to the Marilyn Manson monsters. That was the part of what you hated, not the flashback within the flashback, but what it was flashbacking to.
Those guys work for me.
Yeah, they work fine with me. Edge is like the hot air balloon escape. John, you and I are the world's biggest Ghosts of Mars fans, so.
Did that come out in 65? I want to talk about it.
Well, Joel, you have a science fiction podcast.
Yeah, but we can't talk about Ghost of Mars. I mean, that's like a, that's Criterion, you know, museum piece there. That's, you can't get into it now.
Okay.
It's true.
I'm just saying, you could have a good Ghost of Mars episode.
I was just thinking about Ghost of Mars earlier because I was thinking about, that's John Carpenter, and he,
yeah,
you know, he's got so much good stuff that we've already kind of like covered, or at least talked about and the thing. And then I was thinking about Wes Craven, and it's like, I can't really say the same for some reason. Anyways, we're not talking about that.
No.
Yeah, Wes Craven's not great. I'll go on the record with that. The best ideas with the worst execution.
He's got a couple of good ones, and then, yeah. R.I.P.
But you could say the young doctor goes from being a craven young man to a, I don't know, he's trying
Carpenter
to
of souls.
Into it.
Carpenter of souls. I don't got it.
I wanted to
and
say,
the Ghost of Mars.
I wanted to say when you guys were talking about the, you know, the movie basically being Kurosawa's, I can't phrase the way you were saying it, like the new Japanese cinema tapping into a little bit, but also being analytical about it. Like, I also feel like as an audience member who would be going in expecting a Kurosawa movie, and how shocking that sudden nudity and weirdly violent scene is in that surgery thing, that our reaction would be like the young doctor, you know, like, and later when that guy's like, oh yeah, I fainted the first time too, it's like in reaction to new Japanese cinema.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, and this movie
I think this movie was really
built up too. This was a 2-year production, and they told everyone this is going to be unlike anything you've ever seen.
They did bus tours to the set so people could just look at the sets because they were
huge. They brought in tour buses, and I think it cost something like 4 times what a normal, you know, Toho production would cost. They just sunk everything into it, really built it up as being like the huge new Kurosawa movie. And at that point, he had done a movie a year for 22 years. And this one taking 2 years to make, you know, was like, oh, he's really cooking something up for us, everybody, you know. And I think, you know, on the one hand, going into this, and yeah, there's this the kind of stuff that you don't usually see in a Kurosawa movie, and Fune not being the main character, but more so, I think, you know, it's so subtle and there's so much drama as opposed to, you know, the one fight scene in the movie. I think people would be surprised that didn't turn out to be this epic adventure, you know, and maybe that's the way that Kurosawa kind of turns around on himself more than anything, is the fact that he's doing this very quiet film, 3-hour quiet film that feels epic, even though it's not about a bunch of samurai fighting, you know, bandits or, you know, or even the high and low, you know, with the big crime plot.
Yeah.
I can definitely imagine how the audience would have responded to that.
But it also gets described as being about a doctor and a country doctor. And it's so much about psychological trauma, though. That's the other thing that's fascinating, is that it's about like a suburban psychiatrist as much as it's about anything. And I think that's what's funny about the scene where Shimura's like, does it matter, a good or bad doctor? And Mifune's sort of like, yeah, it doesn't really matter, because the movie's more about bedside manner, your relationship to your patients, your relationship to your profession, matter, the psychological component of it all matters more than the other things you're doing, which is also another way in which it defies expectations.
And what does it matter if we're all going to die anyway? You know, sort of the pessimistic angle, I think, of the movie. But not anything new for Kurosawa. I think he was always interested in that kind of angle. Like, you know, is there any like happiness to be found when there's despair all over, and then ultimately it's going to lead to despair for everybody? So that's
John.
Nice,
I will tell you right now. Yes, I go someplace where there's great birds. So the answer to your question is absolutely. There's beautiful birds I've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
It's neither too hot or too cold. It's great, John.
I want to eat. I want to drink some of that Kool Aid. Pour me a glass. Poor Chobo. He's okay.
Right. yeah. Oh, that kid. He Kershaw used him up until I think Matadayo. I think he shows up in everything after his except.
Oh, does he ever get any less ugly? Sorry. Yeah, that's probably a mean thing to say, but
He plays a.
You'll feel bad after you watch the movies for asking that question.
No.
Well, he plays a developmentally disabled child and their desk cut in. And it's kind of awkward when you see it now.
Yeah, he gives the film its onomatopoeic title.
Yeah.
Yeah, Chris recently brought up that Dodas Kaden feels like a second first film for Kurosawa. And in the context of this film, I think that makes a lot of sense, like just everything we've been saying about how it feels like such a final film. And I think one of the reasons that, not to get too far off this movie, but the Dodas Kaden is less successful than his better-known films is that it's almost kind of like cycling back to something that with Red Beard feels finished, you know? It feels like he has like a real final idea in this movie about, you know, good existing within evil and poverty, you know, contrasted to, you know, people who don't give a shit about the poor people and compassion that can bring those two sects together. It's something that he, you know, I mean, in Ikuru, obviously, Shimura's cancer is, you know, a metaphoric of like his corruption and his, this kind of insensitivity
his
to society.
Cancer.
Yeah, it's a spiritual cancer that's kind of taken over him. And I think with Redbeard, he takes it to like a fuller thing where it's like everyone, it's, you know, everyone in this film, whether it's a psychological or a genuine physical health concern, is tarnished and has, you know, these problems, most of them stemming from being poor. And
yeah,
the characters who finally feel compassion for these people and can find a way beyond that "do doctors matter" question, where they realize that compassion and caring for, you know, your fellow people is the real answer. And at the end of the film, when he's going to stay at the clinic and he's going to continue his work, that feels like the end of the period at the end of a long sentence that Kurosawa was doing over 22 years. You know, you can even compare this movie to High and Low to say, you know, what Mifune learns in that film, you know, when he brings himself down to save the chauffeur's son, is, you know, the same thing that this doctor goes through in this movie. So to go to Dodas Kaden and kind of like start over again and say, okay, now we're going to start again in the slum and we're going to have these new ideas about how these people survive. It's like, oh, but I think you answered that question.
Yeah.
You know?
A lot of it feels like him trying to invent a new style. And I don't necessarily, I mean, I love some of those post-Redbeard movies, but I do also feel like they're too painterly. They're too well put together. I think give him 5 years to make a movie and it's too precise. And I think that I like him better when he's looser.
Yeah, I could see that.
And I think that, yeah, the apex of it is Ran, which is a phenomenal film, but I think that the best qualities about Ran are actually the worst qualities about Kagemusha and Dodas Kaden. And Dreams, which is a movie I don't think very much of at all either.
Hmm.
I totally see what you're saying. Yeah, I agree. I think I agree. I like a lot of those movies, but this this period between Stray Dog and that we were saying, like, I think this is really like the Cure Kurosawa for a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you should include Drunken Angel in that period too.
Is Drunken Angel right before Stray Dog? It should be Drunken Angel. I fucked that up then. It should absolutely include Drunken Angel.
That's the first one with Toshiro in it.
For some reason, see, that one's so good, I always think of it as coming, like, at the height of his power, not right at the beginning. Yeah, no, I concede the point. You win.
Yeah. Podcast over.
Thank you. Also, one of my favorite movies of all
time.
John
Carpenter's The Ghost of Mars. All right.
Yes. And Drunken Angel.
It's a close second.
So when it comes to his later films after this point, I feel like Derzu Asala kind of doesn't have the weaker points of the films that took a longer time, and I'm wondering if it's because he had to shoot in, he was shooting in an environment that it seemed more
wild.
Well, it's him going so far out of his wheelhouse. That's one of the ones I really like. I just watched that one again about a month and a half ago, maybe longer, whenever it was on TCM recently. Ooh. I watched it, and that's one that I feel like, he, like, it's kind of really exciting to see him do something completely different, you know? And I agree. That's one that feels like what he should have been doing after Redbeard. If Redbeard is, like, ending the thought, as John says, and I think that's a really good way of sort of thinking about it, him exploring with Dersu Urzala, and that's a film that's obviously about literal, you know, sort of exploring of landscapes as well. I wish he had done more of that rather than sort of retreating into very, very precise period films that sort of have a patina of artificiality baked into them really deliberately. You know, I wish he had gone bananas in some way. I wish he had failed more.
Although I think Rhapsody in August kind of falls into the category of, like, the older style where it was made a lot quicker, because that came the year after Dreams. So he didn't have, like, a whole half a decade to cook it up. He was kind of this, after Dreams, just went right into this very kind of Ozu-ish family drama.
Yeah,
or even like I Live in Fear, one of his earlier films, they kind of are nice companion pieces to each other. I think Redbeard, I mean, I feel like I'm kind of dogging Redbeard a little bit, like focusing on like the things I don't like about it. I should mention I love this movie. I think it's really great. I think of the top tier Kurosawa, the ones that everyone talks about, I think it's the most underrated of those. You know, I think everyone respects it for what it is, but I feel like not grouping it with Seven Samurai or Throne of Blood is wrong. You know, I think it is just as much of an achievement as those films. And definitely, you know, a step above his next tier, which are, you know, his great films that aren't Kurosawa masterpieces, you know, just plain old masterpieces.
Yeah. Just amazingly great films, not possibly the greatest film ever made.
Right.
That next tier down.
That's the next tier down for Kurosawa.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. It's funny. I always feel like when I watched Redbeard this time, I was thinking, you know, it's interesting. I feel like Akira gets its due now. And I think Akira is the film in his filmography that that Redbeard's most similar to. Or maybe some of like the early ones like that aren't as good, like One Wonderful Sunday or something. But but I feel like Akira gets its due now when people have seen it and it's really meaningful to people. And I don't feel like Redbeard has been discovered in that way. I agree with you, John, that it feels somehow like it gets left out of the conversation.
Yeah.
I think part of that might be just the runtime for, like, some people, 3 hours might be like, yeah, no, that's not going to do that.
Yeah. And I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, not everyone has patience for a 3-hour movie. I do, for the most part, but I know, like, a lot of my friends and, like, coworkers I know would, if I described Redbeard, they'd be like, yeah, I'm not going to watch that.
My philosophy on film length is movies should be 85 minutes long and funny or over 3 hours. The worst runtime for a movie is bad if it's 2 hours and 20 minutes long. They did something wrong with their movie to have it be that length. It's a movie that wants to be an hour and 45 and they couldn't get it there. Or it's a movie that needs to be 3 hours long and they were afraid. But no movie is 2 hours and 20 minutes long.
That philosophy was adopted by the Pink Smoke. Yes. That's the official Pink Smoke stance right there.
85 minutes long and funny. Bang. Good movie.
Yeah, Star Wars is pretty good.
Is it 85 minutes long? I don't
know. No, it's longer.
It's like 2 hours. Yeah, it goes over 2 hours. I think all the Star Wars movies do.
And all the Marvel movies are like 2 hours, 20 minutes now.
Yeah. Proof positive.
Yeah, you just proved his point.
Although,
I like those movies. Hey, this is obviously not something I really believe. Like anything I say, I don't actually believe.
Wait, how long is Ghost of Mars?
I think that comes
85
in
minutes long.
Yeah, too long.
85, I think.
Nice.
Carpenter knew when he knew when to call it quits. For
and
sure.
it's pretty funny when Pam Grier says, "Who goes there?" It's pretty funny. Is that, does she say it, or does Natasha Henstridge say it, John?
I don't know. I don't remember that.
It's because it's the nod.
I remember it's the novelization of the thing, but that's all I remember.
No, one of them says it. They're like, here in goings on, and they say, "Who goes there?" And the audience I saw it with at the Palisades Mall erupted in laughter at that line.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we shouldn't have thought about that. Can't just please the John W. Campbell fans in the audience.
So Spencer, where do you rank Redbeard? How did you feel about this one? You've been doing the podcast, you've been watching them all. You're an aficionado's aficionado. What do you think about it? Like in his pantheon, do you think it's Seven Samurai level?
I'm not sure. Like, I'm still, like, I remember the first time I saw it, I loved it, but this time I don't like it. I don't love it nearly as much, but I still did enjoy it. But it's just, I don't know. Like, it definitely is, like, for me, like, top tier Kurosawa, like, easily, I'd say, like, top 10 for me. But it's not. But I think I have to sit with it a little longer, and I think I have to like just let it sink in for a little bit longer before I can really like really place it in like the pantheon.
That's legit. This is a movie that really upon reappraisal, I think really benefits. I remember when I watched all the films again for his 100th birthday article. Hidden Fortress and Redbeard were the two that I like came out of like, oh, these movies, holy shit. I totally had put them away in a drawer, but they are great and they need to be talked about along with all the rest of them.
You know what my favorite was for the longest time? For like, till I was like 25, for like 10 years, I was convinced Sanjuro. I was convinced Sanjuro was the best one. It's so strange to me now. Like, I love Sanjuro. It's strange to me to think that I was like, that's the one. Sanjuro, I don't know why people don't talk about it. I guess I was more impressed with geometric composition back then.
I know, for me, Sanjuro, I've seen... it's one of those I've seen the most. And I like it.
It's a breeze. To watch.
Yeah, in terms of, like, just pure fun, it's more fun than Yojimbo, but Yojimbo is definitely the better, more technical movie, but Sanjuro is just so much fun.
See, of all of the really great ones, I put Yojimbo probably lower than anybody, you know? I really like it, but I think that, you know, when I think about the ones I love, they're just so towering and so amazing. And Yojimbo just never hit that way for me. And I wonder if it's because I first saw it too young, as life-changing as it was to see it. You know, maybe 15 is too young for it to hit you completely right, you know?
Maybe. So Joel, where would you, like, where would you rank Redbeard of the ones you've seen so far?
I mean, it's obviously, like you were saying, like they were saying, it's top-tier stuff. I do think, like, it's,
are you having trouble
being this first time that I watched it? Like, sometimes I have trouble with 3-hour movies, like you were talking about, but I did not want to stop watching this. I was fully into it the entire time.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I keep mixing up my order, like, of what things I liked most. Like, I don't remember what I said last time my top movie is. Right now I'm feeling like High and Low is my top one. Because
I think you did say High and Low last time.
I just really dig the whole police procedural bits stuff.
Oh, you're gonna like Stray Dog when you get to it.
Oh yeah, you're gonna love Stray Dog. Hell yeah. You're in for a treat.
A Hidden Fortress is all the way up there too. Like, those two are probably fighting it off. And Seven Samurai, it belongs in a museum, as far as I'm concerned. But now, and having mentioned those, I think that Redbeard might be right below, right there. So, like, in the top five. You know, I also still really love The Bad Sleep Well. The rewatch of Rashomon was, like, that's one where I didn't really know anything about movies, so I didn't know what was the big deal about it when I first watched it. And then with this rewatch, I was like, oh my gosh, my eyes are open.
Yeah.
I really like The Bad Sleep Well a lot.
Some guy made all these movies.
Who's that guy?
Fucking think about that. Jesus Christ, what a director. Anyway.
but Joel, like, are you having trouble, like, just grappling, like, this, the, what Redbeard is, just in terms of, like, it's this sheer scope of the movie?
What you mean.
Like,
is it a comedy?
Yes. I don't know. It's just, no, it's for me, it's not like the idiot level difficult, but it kind of veers a bit into the being a little difficult.
Oh, sure. I mean, this, he brought out all most of his tricks for this movie, and the kind of like vignette style of the story that way kind of makes you wonder where it's going to end up. Like, as you guys were saying before, it's obvious that the young doctor is going to learn something, and at the end he's going to be a better person because of it. But not everything in the story is obvious like that. And it's kind of crazy that way. The one scene that stands out the most for me is after that man who wasn't speaking dies.
And he's one of the peasants from Hidden Fortress.
And his daughter comes, you know, and she's telling her sob story and all this stuff like that. And after she's done doing that, she asks, did he suffer? You know, he couldn't have suffered. Please tell me he didn't. And Redbeard says, no, he didn't suffer. And then we focus in and music starts on the young doctor, who immediately remembers the man choking, you know, slowly choking to death, obviously in pain. And that's, it was just like that moment. I was like, what is this freaking masterpiece? What's going on here? You know? Yeah. And that's like, that kind of thing doesn't happen again in the movie. It's not like a thing that's going to keep coming back. But like you were saying,
does. Mifune makes a lot of, his character makes a lot of sort of morally expedient maneuvers, is one of the things that I think is interesting about his goodness, is that it's not based in being truthful, it's not based in being generous, it's based in an idea of compassion, which makes him, he occasionally lies a few times to spare people's feelings, or manipulates people with made-up stories, or is cruel. And I think that's actually one of the fascinating things about that character, is that he lies to the daughter there.
Yeah.
You know,
even after beating down all the guys outside the brothel, he feels bad about it instantly.
Yeah,
he's ashamed with himself.
Yeah, I went too far with this.
Yeah,
no, there's just a couple of bones sticking out. It's fine, Mr. Beard.
I love when he fixes the guy's jaw and the guy still looks like, get the fuck away from me.
That guy's like the Terminator. I don't want him to touch me again either. Jeez.
You know what scene I found really funny this time watching this time is the final wedding mm-hmm. scene when Redbeard's still there, like, bossing the young doctor around. I just feel like that doctor must be like, can I just do my fucking wedding, Redbeard? Like, you're not in charge of my wedding, okay?
Yeah. Cut to the wedding night.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah, like, their relationship felt kind of like a loving but disappointed stepfather and his new stepson.
Yeah.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
Like he's not mean, but he's kind of has higher standards than what the stepson is used to.
And kind of doesn't understand that it's helpful to relate to people, you know? Like, that doesn't seem to have mm-hmm. an understanding that, like, you're making things harder on yourself by not being clear. Which is one of the things that I think prevents it from being a, like, a Dr. House, brilliant, persnickety doctor, is Redbeard makes a few decisions that even Redbeard is like, God, was that the right thing to do? You know? And he lets mm-hmm. himself get pushed around a few times, like when Shimura chisels him and knocks the amount mm-hmm. of the fee down, and he just sort of takes it, you know, and then says, hey, you gotta butter up mm-hmm. rich doctors afterwards. There's moments in the movie where it's not like the superhero genius doctor. It's like the guy who is hard to get along with and is maybe not always right.
That even plays into what I was thinking about the portrayal of women in the movie, where the madam comes back to fetch Atoyo back to the, you know, brothel, and he just levels her with insults, you know, telling yeah. her that she stinks and, you know, her nose
your was soul
so
rotten, is rotten.
Fell off. Yeah, and it's like, you don't have to tell it like it is, Mr. Redbeard. where it really is like, oh, geez, like, I feel bad for her. He's going after her so badly, even though she's obviously a horrible person, and he's right.
he's also completely ineffective. The madam doesn't leave until the nurses beat her up with beets.
His words inspire that, you know, passion in them to beat her up, obviously.
Do they? I like that scene because he's not in charge in that scene. That's one of the things I like about that scene is he does the Redbeard thing and it doesn't work. Like, that lady knows how to just walk straight through it.
Huh.
And that the men are sort of paralyzed and helpless.
Hmm. Yeah. But,
that, like, shit works on time. Young doctors, but not madams.
That'll work on the mantis, but not a seasoned...
Hey, can you guys excuse me for 1 second? I need to run to the restroom for 1 minute. Keep talking, and I'll be back and rejoin. Yeah.
I think the madam has seen a lot worse things than just like a grumpy old doctor.
Undoubtedly, she has. Yeah.
I feel like even though it's vignettes, I feel like the central relationships. I think you mentioned, John, that we keep shifting for protagonists, but I feel like it's the central relationship in the first pre-intermission is Redbeard and the young doctor kind of figuring each other out, and then post-intermission when the 12-year-old girl, they basically adopt that 12-year-old girl, like her and the young doctor. Like, she kind of takes the place of Redbeard and, like, teaching him how to be a better person.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting trick where you don't really expect that to happen, where you see him, like, becoming, like, you know, a more caring doctor and physician when he's taking care of her and trying to bring her out of her shell and her psychological hang-ups. But then when he falls ill and she becomes the one to take care of him, yeah, it's something you don't really expect, and it's kind of neat. I like that kind of flip-flops on him a little bit. Because I like that he does that Kurosawa comes out of his comfort shell a little bit like that, because so many of his films are young man and old man, whether it's Stray Dog or Seven Samurai.
Dare to Uzala.
And that dynamic between, like, two men. So in the middle of the movie to switch it over and have her be such a big part of the film, gives a sort of like a universality I think that it didn't have before, and kind of moves past what Kurosawa usually does with his films, so I definitely appreciated that. And even thinking about Seven Samurai, the female characters are practically non-existent, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, there's the one daughter who we first see when she's bent over in front of her dad in that kind of weird sexualized yeah. shot. And she has like the Star of David on her dress, which is like, why is there Star of David there? it looks like the Star of David. Look for the screenshot. Like, I thought she was supposed to be Jewish the first time I saw it.
Could be. I never noticed that before. I'll have to look in on that. But peripheral, right? A lot of the women. I mean, I think Chris is absolutely right by saying that.
Mm-hmm.
He was definitely trying to do a, you know, more of a, not a women's picture, but a film that focused a lot more on female protagonists and kind of brought them more to the forefront than his previous films did. I mean, you got the princess in Hidden Fortress is obviously a great character.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I guess she's still the princess who has to be protected, you know.
And you also had the character Yuki from No Regrets.
Right, right. Yeah, oh, yeah, in his earlier films, I think.
Yeah.
When he had...
The first four modern ones.
Yeah, where he had the films... A lot of women in them. The women's factory. Yeah, those were a lot more. But what's neat, I think, is that he has Kiyoko Kagawa playing the Mantis, you know, the mad woman in this movie. And she had previously played Mifune's wife in High and Low... and Bad Sleep Well, you know, so she's kind of like moving into a different position, you know, within the Kurosawa narrative where she's this unstable kind of psycho woman who would be become his like favorite female character, I think, between this and Ron, you know. I think that was something in Throne of Blood that he was trying to do that he couldn't quite get there with the Lady Macbeth character. But by the time he got to Ron, he was like, oh yeah, I know about the crazy psycho bitch who's going to try to kill everybody.
That's what's so weird about this movie, though, and I think what makes it hard to understand in the context of Kurosawa is that it is about female trauma, and even Rashomon, where that should ostensibly be the focus of the film, is by the wayside. Mm-hmm. That it's so far outside of his wheelhouse for what he normally does to make a movie about female trauma and sexual violence and female subjugation in Japan. You know, that's Mizoguchi, that's Naruse stuff, that is not Kurosawa stuff. And I do think that it's not a slam dunk. I think that all of us saying, there's something that makes you feel a little uncomfortable occasionally with watching it, I think is very fair. And I do think, you know, the one subplot was supposedly inspired by... Insulted and Injured, the Dostoevsky book, and he's obviously a big Dostoevsky fan. He does have a bit of Dostoevsky creepy, like, and a young blonde virgin will redeem us all, like that thing that ruins so many Dostoevsky books, of like this obsession with like perfect young virgins, right? Which is like by far the worst thing about Dostoevsky. That seeps into this a little bit, you know, like his only artistic hero's handling of women is like notoriously terrible, you know. And I think that gets in this a little bit and combines with the extremity of new Japanese cinema's depictions of these issues and is a little queasy. You know, I don't think he botches it. I don't think there's anything indefensible in this film, but I do think it's another one of those elements that makes it, when you watch this movie, you say, what is this movie? You know,
I agree, but I do like that he takes the Nelly character from Humiliated and the Injured, that he like takes a character from a completely different work and puts it in it. It must be a Japanese thing, because it reminded me of Miyazaki using the character from Magic Mountain in The Wind Rises, you know, like just borrowing characters from literature whenever you feel like it and inserting them into your completely unrelated movie.
It's called fanfic, John, and the Japanese invented it. Just, I don't know if it, none of that's true, probably. I'm no expert.
So, Joel, did you like the portrayal of women compared to other Kurosawa's.
Don't ask me questions like that. What are you? I'm not making okay. notes here. Come on. No, I'm just kidding.
I know, but it's notably different compared to everything else, pretty much.
I mean, there's a lot of different sections in this movie that I feel are different than the things that we've watched. Yeah, that like I said, like the you guys were talking about before. I do feel like he's influenced by the other films of the era and just sticking a couple of things in there, but
even having the kids in this movie,
yeah.
What other Kurosawa movies have major parts for children? Hmm. You know, before this one,
major parts.
You know, it's very rare to have a character like Chobo.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, I guess Dreams, the opening,
but that's after this.
Opening you segment. Know, right?
That's after yeah. this.
Well, it's funny because you brought this up in the High and Low episode, and I immediately when I heard it thought Chobo is a kid from its movies.
Yeah, but obviously Chobo's those are a bigger, perfect examples of kids that are just like non-characters almost in High and Low.
Of course.
Yeah.
Examples of some kids who need to fucking remember better.
You know, I was thinking
where their kidnappers took them.
You know, they're thinking about a very like non-Kurosawa scene, the one I was talking about, the flashback sequences with the woman, the wife that comes back with the baby, and how eerie that sequence is. I was thinking about the scene that I love in Seven Samurai, where the mother of the dead farmer comes out with the sai to kill the bandit, the wind is sweeping, you know, her kimono, and she's this old woman holding up this gigantic weapon, and it's just and everyone's just staring at her silently. It's this really chilling moment where the bandit is, you know, looks terrified that this old woman is just going to saw his head off, you know, right there in front of everybody. So that's a scene that I think, you know, now that I think of it, kind of evokes that for me a little bit.
There's that great shot in Redbeard too. Is there a line? Mm-hmm. It's time to end it all, or it was time to end it all when she's like in front of the sun and the clouds behind her, and that made me think of like how famous he is for filming the sun in Rashomon, you know, and how that was like such a big breakthrough is that they, you know, film the sun directly. And that, like, oh, here's another shot of the sun, but with, like, the smoke and the earthquake around her. She's in, like, the rubble in that moment, I think.
Yeah,
The whole flashback to me felt like a Mizoguchi type, like that type of filming. And, like, the whole, like, someone mentioned earlier, it felt kind of ghostly. Mm-hmm. And that part made me think of Ugetsu.
Absolutely, Ugetsu. Or even some of the parts of Sancho, I think.
Oh, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with both points. two points for everybody.
I was just adding on to the previous point. It wasn't Spencer's point on that. But it's crazy to think that there's only 15 years that separate this film from Rashomon. You know, that he had come so far and done so much in that amount of time. He and Mifune, you know.
Yeah.
That's
crazy. Yeah, don't we need to talk about at some point on here how like this movie ruined his relationship with Mifune? Or is that like, do people just know the story that like he told Mifune like you're gonna be sleeping on mats for 2 years, and Mifune was like, yeah, no, I'm a movie star now. I'm not ever doing that again. Like, goodbye.
Well, the one anecdote I've heard, because I never knew exactly what like the rift was, other than like they just needed some time apart from each other, was that he insisted on him having the beard, and they had to use all these different kind of chemicals to get the beard exactly the way he wanted, so it always smelled bad. But he, Mifune, because he wasn't able to do another film for 2 years, was like, I got to do some commercials to make some money. And Kurosawa was like, not with that beard, you're not, that's my fucking beard, you know? Wow. That's my red beard, so you can't be in a beer commercial with my beard. And so he couldn't even do that.
Yeah, no, all of the stories I have heard are that, like, Mifune was like, I'm Mifune now. And, like, I'm not here to be anything other than to be, like, a real goddamn international movie star. Like, I'm not doing only your movie for 2 years. I'm not only doing your beard chemicals. I'm not sleeping on the mats in this set you built. There are stories of, like, maybe apocryphal of, like, Kurosawa wanted them to sleep there every night. Can you imagine, you know, like asking him to do that at that point? But a lot of these are also sort of apocryphal stories that I've heard that I don't know whether they're true or not.
Well, I did hear that he wanted people to sleep on the mattresses like a year before they even started filming, just to give that slept in feel, which obviously you can tell looking at them.
That Von Stroheim, like, even the underwear has got to be correct, where it's like, you know what? I don't think it does. And watching it this time, I was really struck by when they're out in the field. There's this one scene where, like, you hear all about, like, all the money they spent on these sets and all of the attention paid to detail. And there's a shot where I know it must be the real background of, I think it's of, like, the rice plains, but it looks fake. Yeah. It looks like the worst fake backdrop, and it must be real because they spent so much goddamn money on this movie that there's no way they just put like a cheap photo there, but it looks terrible. That's all I could think this time watching it.
I noticed that one too, and I was wondering if the artificiality of that shot was intentional, you know, if so what he was trying to get at with that. But yeah,
well, it cuts in later and they're down in the rice paddy, so it's like they must have been there at some point, but yeah, it looks fucking awful. Or is that just presaging Dodesky?
Even in that scene, when the woman is stumbling in the rice paddy, like the background still looks fake somehow, even though it's obvious that she's stepping in one.
Yeah, that she's in like the mud. Yeah, no, it's very strange. Another thing I was struck by watching it was those like woodblock pillows they use for the sick people. Yeah. That can't be helping anything. Let those sick people put their heads down.
didn't look comfortable.
Yeah, and when their like heads tumble off in a sickly thump, it's like just leave them on the ground. I know.
Or get a real pillow.
Yeah.
Only the most comfortable wood blocks.
I suppose it's part of his. We keep all of the German moisture mats out of here that we hear about early in the film.
The first patient that died, Roku Suke, that character, when he would speak, and it was very but he was like clearly choking and suffering, that reminded me, there's a resident at the nursing home where I work who every single meal, he chokes on everything.
Oh, no.
And he makes sounds just like that pretty much every day, every single meal. And it's at first it's horrifying, but then you kind of get used to it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I can
see that. Yeah,
yeah.
And I think that's the same way you get used to this film. Like, you know, I said the initiation, you know, at first is like, I don't want to spend 3 hours in this film, and then just like the young doctor, you're like, I want to help these people. I want to be there, and I want to like see them through, and I want to shout Chobo's name into the well and get him back. You know, you're totally on board with it.
I like how long it takes in that initial introduction of like, this is the place that sucks, you know? It takes, like, a good 20 minutes. A lot of movies, you know, those scenes are 3 minutes. I like that this movie takes 3 hours because it's about how people change or don't change is one of its themes, right? Is, like, do people become different in some way? You know, the nature versus nurture of, like, the mantis. Like, she was born that way. Lots of people have trauma. That's who she is like one of the open questions of the movie. And since it's about the doctor changing, the young doctor, and deciding he wants to be something different, to making a decision to do something different for his life, I like that it uses time to say that takes time, you know? You know, John, if I can change and you can change, what does it take to change the essence of a man? That's what I'm looking for, John.
Time. Any time.
Music video montage.
But John and I just did a scene from On Deadly Ground. We're keeping it secret, Steven Seagal, for this podcast.
Was that the one that has an environmental message?
It's the one that ends with like a 10-minute speech about how the government is suppressing the electric car. It's got more than a message. Okay. It's got an environmental spirit. It's got a soul.
Oh, wait, that's a Michael Caine one?
Yeah, John, what did Michael Caine have to say about that movie when you asked him?
So Michael Caine came to the Jacob Burns Film Center where Chris Funderburg used to program with his new film. And I asked a question, which was, it was completely indirect. It was like, what's it like? Do you have a different approach to working for directors like John Huston versus a Huston, director like, I don't know, Steven Seagal? And they misunderstood my question and thought I was just asking about working with Steven Seagal. And he was like, who? And the interviewer, Janet Maslin, was like, Steven Seagal, you're in his film On Deadly Ground? Oh, I remember that film. He told me, I'm not going to direct you at all. And I told him, that's a good idea.
So this is the Steven Seagal cast we're doing, right?
He was willing to dye his hair black, however.
Absolutely.
Oily black.
Yes.
The beginning part when the young doctor is getting the tour of the location, you know, he's seen mm-hmm. all the different rooms, and the guy's basically like, mm-hmm. you have to do this, and you got to make sure to do this stuff. Did that remind you of the third Kagemusha? Or the third shadow, rather? What was it called? You know what I mean?
No. The third Shadow Warrior.
At that. After they decide he's going to be one of the doubles, and they're like telling him everything he has to do, it just made me think of that.
Oh yeah. I see what you're talking about. It does feel like that like montage
and
section.
Getting thrown into the deep end, whether or not they're ready.
Just reminds me of camping.
Well, that does.
Like after 5 minutes, you're like,
Was that the section in Third Shadow Warrior where he like has to have sex with the
that's
the concubine.
Part of it, yeah. I mean that's after he's already grown his beard or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
He doesn't grow a beard, whatever happens.
Yeah.
He learns how to dunk. Am I remembering that movie correctly? After he learns how to dunk.
That is correct. Yes.
Yeah, sex with the concubine.
Yes. Mhm. Listen to our episode on the Third Shadow Warrior, which was in December. Right after the Heinlo episode.
I thought we just recorded this. What happened?
Do you guys have any other points you want to bring up about Redbeard?
I do want to say to the listener, the reason why we didn't actually just go through the plot like we normally do is because this is one of those movies where a lot of things happen, but it's not exactly like a storytelling. Because there are like five or six different stories that seem to happen within this 3-hour movie. So it would be a whole jumble of me trying to remember who said what and when this person died and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. And I see it as like, it's kind of five different episodes kind of interweaved together in a strange way.
Yeah, it's very loose. Definitely. I guess that was kind of setting up for what Kurosawa would do from that point on. You know, I feel like Dodas Kaden, and then later on with Dreams, you know, you get that kind of very loose structure where you're kind of following one person and then another, and it's vignette-y.
Yeah, as you said, like, it's him finishing a thought, like, it's him being like, this is the last time I'm going to make this kind of movie, and it feels like he kind of used this experience to be like, oh, I can do like a kind of a weird weaving type of movie, and did Dodas Kaden.
It is weird. You know what I was thinking too? I don't necessarily need to make a lot of points, but it also feels like he, even though guys like Mifune and Shimura are in it, it doesn't feel like his troupe of actors the way so many of his movies from that era does. And I think that there's something very distinct that happens to his work when he starts using different groups of actors and goes to color. Those two things go together. As much as I love Nakadai in his movies, it's just a different thing than like the Mifune Shimura era.
Yeah.
You know, even though
Hidro Tono.
You know, even though Nakadai is in some of those movies, he's always sort of the the shallow, glib character frequently, you know, or the operator in yeah. some way. He's not the, like, big, complex character.
No.
It's part of my passive nature.
I love you too, John. I love you too. Were you going to say that? Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say it's part of my passive nature to defer to bigger experts than me. I'm going to go to the OG Curacao expert, Donald Ritchie, because I just love this one thing he said about the movie, which is, speaking about specifically the Mifune character, he will do anything to get at it, even things he considers bad. He does more than merely devote himself to the good. He devotes himself to a fight against bad. This is why the picture is not sentimental. To simply feel for, sympathize with, weep over, this is sentimental because it is so ridiculously disproportionate to what is needed. But to gird the loins and go out and do battle, to hate so entirely that good is the result, this is something else.
That's awesome.
Right?
Yeah. I love Don Ritchie.
He's the
I
man.
Have his Ozu book.
I always feel bad for Donald Ritchie when they trot him out to talk about Japanese directors he clearly doesn't know much about. When they have him, was that the Imamura thing we were reading, John? Do you remember? And he was like, "Pshaw, he's good." You know, that kind of quote.
Yeah. Stick to Kurosawa.
I haven't read much Ritchie. Was he a fan of Seijun Suzuki?
That seems like exactly the kind of thing he got asked about that he didn't actually know anything about.
Yeah, I'm sure he's probably more, if anybody else, probably more of a Mizoguchi guy.
Oh, it's funny that I haven't said Seijun Suzuki's name this whole podcast when talking about the new Japanese cinema, when that's clearly the biggest influence on what Kurosawa becomes. Kagemusha and Ran and Dodesuka Din have the most in common with Seijun Suzuki of all those guys, of sort of the theatrical artificiality and over-prepared settings, the almost like dance-like minutiae of arranging things within the frame is a very Suzuki tendency.
Which is kind of nice that like he would stylistically start to imitate Suzuki, who obviously was inspired by Stray Dog and Drunken Angel, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that was one more thing I was watching too, thinking, sorry, just to keep, I'm going to steamroll you motherfuckers. Here's some Funderburg ideas. Strap in. No, I always think about how Kurosawa wasn't beloved by like the French New Wave because the Kaede Cinema guys, because they found him to be too American and too Western, right? And I think this is one movie where that manifests itself really interestingly in like it's, you know, they don't like that he uses like Haydn on his soundtracks, you know, and like the classical music and stuff, and that he has like an American style of filmmaking, which is why his movies end up influencing, you know, Westerns and American directors so much. And this is a movie where I definitely felt that a lot, where it felt like this is really interesting to see, again, in contrast to both the Mizoguchi Ozu types and the Oshima Imamura types, that he really does, there is something that's very Western about his flavor in this movie, that there is something that feels like the characters feel like, this is so strange to say, like recognizably American in their behaviors. Maybe Redbeard and the young doctor do, you know, and the type of stories that this movie is like are, you know, they remind you of American stories. You can see how Star Wars grows out of what Kurosawa does, and how Fistful of Dollars grows out of what Kurosawa does, and how he influences Arthur Penn and Sam Peckinpah and other people that claim him as a great influence, Coppola and Spielberg and all of those people. And I think that it's fascinating that when you talk about an austere 3-hour movie about a country doctor made in Japan, that it's actually reminds me most of Hollywood movies and not of Bresson. You know what I mean? That this movie is not Diary of a Country Priest. You know, this movie is not Tarkovsky. You know, this movie has something. He's just like a very good entertainer deep down in his soul, you know, in a way that you associate with Hollywood, or one does, you know? And I think that's something that's fascinating about this movie, is that it's not defined by, like, the kind of austerity and contemplativeness that you might think when you have it described to you.
I agree. I think he's still completely entrenched in that era of Kurosawa, you know? That this film is always going to have more in common with High and Low and Seven Samurai than it would his later artier movies. You know, I think that there's still very much that entertainment quality to it, even outside of just the fight scene, but the way you care about the characters and the way the characters fall in love and the way they die, you know, is definitely more in tune with the Western sensibility, like a lot of his earlier films are, or that films from that era, from the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, you don't need to see this and feel like... I just remember I had a critic tell me once whose expertise was Iranian cinema, like, you can't understand Iranian cinema without, like, a guidebook to what these symbols and cultural symbols mean, you know? And you never feel that way with Kurosawa. Like, I gotta read up on the Tokugawa era before I watch Redbeard. Like, you don't feel like, what is, you know, this place's relationship to Edo? What was Edo? Like, you don't need that kind of guidebook to understand his films. Mm-hmm. And maybe they're not Western. Maybe they're just universal.
Yeah.
You know?
But definitely that Western mentality, of, you know, reaching the widest possible audience, you know?
Yeah.
I think is definitely in his psyche.
Yeah, before we get to your guys' picks for 1965 movies, a couple of quick things. First, did you two ever read that Paul Schrader introduced Ozu to Hollywood?
Read that he did, or read the book he wrote about Ozu and Bresson? And who's the third motherfucker in that book, John?
Dreyer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good book.
But on the episode we did on Ozu, Joel and I were kind of trying to wrap our heads around the fact that Paul Schrader apparently is very influenced by Ozu, and he said apparently Taxi Driver is influenced by Ozu.
I've met Paul Schrader several times, and he is, unlike a lot of filmmakers are not cinephiles. Paul Schrader knows an incredible amount about movies, and that all makes sense.
Okay.
You know, he gets a lot of that from his brother, Leonard Schrader, obviously. Mm-hmm. He sort of absorbs,
rest in peace,
yeah, his brother's knowledge on that. But I completely believe, you know, and he wrote that, he wrote a great book, which I haven't read for years and years, on Ozu and Dreyer and Bresson. That's about that sort of transcendental cinema. Isn't that just the title of it, John?
Yeah.
But it's about that kind of austere, ascetic cinema, and he's incredibly knowledgeable, and he has really interesting ideas that I end up returning to a lot. There's this idea of, like, into film stasis that I think about a lot, and how that functions.
And he was 19 when he wrote that book too. He was being groomed by Pauline Kael to be like the next great film writer, and then decided he wanted to make movies instead. But I'm glad you brought up Leonard, though. Obviously, Leonard Schrader was the one who was really fascinated with Japan.
Had me very confused.
Oh, yeah,
for
no,
a
it's
while.
Completely legit. And Scorsese is obviously a real deal cinephile as well, who really knows all of that stuff. There's a funny story. John, have I ever told you the story? I heard Isabella Rossellini talking once about why she had to break up with Scorsese, which was that he and his friends would just sit around in the living room smelling film. They would just get, like, 35mm reels in and smell film. And she was just like, I can't deal with this. Like, I don't want to be around guys like this.
Yeah, of course you told me that. That's great.
What's wrong with that?
I just feel like if Isabella Rossellini's there, like, you're right. Who the fuck wants to smell film?
My wife doesn't mind, although I smell other people's feet. So.
Jordy smells film more than anyone, I bet. I bet you two motherfuckers sit around smelling film all goddamn day.
True.
Polaroid just has this smell that's...
So thank you for clarifying that. So you guys have a couple 1965 movies you want to bring up that you really like?
I'm going to jump out in front of John because John recommended me to this one. High Wind in Jamaica. This is a boy's adventure tale that I really, really enjoyed from 1965. John had watched it. We did a swashbuckler episode of another podcast. And it's not really a swashbuckler, but it is a really enjoyable film. It's Alexander McKendrick and Anthony Quinn and James Coburn. And it's just like about, you know, some kids who go out and get involved with high seas adventure. And that is a great movie from 1965.
Goldfinger's in it.
That's right.
Goldfinger?
He's the captain, the German captain at the end of the movie who gets stabbed to death.
Okay.
You know, for kids.
Yeah.
No, it's a good. It's like it'll make you wanna go, like, you know, swab the decks for like swarthy men. God, I'm getting into it just talking about it. Great theme song too. Great theme song. Are we gonna do back
Johnny
and forth?
The Saragossa Manuscript is one of my favorite movies. Polish film from that year. It's the most Boonwellian film not made by Boonwell. It's just this phantasmagoria of we're talking about like Redbeard being loose and having no real structure.
Mm-hmm.
This is a film that literally moves from one person to another, and within a story, you know, gets lost in like a person's story, and then starts following characters from that story. And you have a frame narrative where they find this manuscript during the Napoleonic Wars, and they're reading about the things that are happening. So you're like delving into a book and then into someone's story, and it's just, you get lost in it. It is hilarious. It is just a beautifully bizarre film.
A-plus movie.
Yeah, it just does not get mentioned enough, and I definitely got to take this opportunity to say everyone should see it. It is just, every time you see it, something different. Love it.
John, is it one of your top 50 films of all time? I think it might be for me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love this one.
Yeah.
Is it easily available?
It was on DVD for a while. I know that I originally saw it. I ordered it from Netflix. I guarantee they don't have it anymore since they got rid of all their back catalog. So I think you could probably buy it. Mm. I don't know if it's out of print or not, but it's been released. I haven't, which I had to play on three different players before I could get it to play. But but it's out there. If you get a chance to see it, I highly recommend it. The book too is fantastic. The book is great.
Do we do a second one? How many do we do? Because my second one is going to be The Knack and How to Get
You're
It
letting them run
by
wild
Richard Lester. Like, what matters is you should see The Knack and How to Get It. It's Richard Lester at like the height of his powers. It's like a swinging London comedy that is, calling it politically incorrect is not right. It's like incendiary sexual politics treated like one of Richard like Help or Hard Day's Night. Done in like that style of just like wild freewheeling comedy. And it's great. It's a movie I came around on. It was one that for years John Cribbs was like, "You're an idiot that you don't like that movie." And I finally watched it again recently and I was like, "I'm a fucking idiot. This movie's great." And but definitely like a trigger warning movie, I would say. But it's completely, if you like Richard Lester when he's doing his like bedsitting room Help style freewheeling, just completely energetic filmmaking, this is one of the big ones for it. And I think it's, you know, it's a lot like Redbeard.
And another great song too. So when I hear 1965, like one of the other movie that immediately comes up is Sidney Lumet's The Hill. Although the Pure Cinema podcast did a prison themed episode recently where they talked about it, and I highly, instead of talking about it right now, I highly recommend everyone go, if it's okay for me to recommend another podcast on your guys' podcast.
No, I'm just kidding, yeah.
And then shut it down. They talked about it, and I don't think I could add anything to what they said. They, you know, perfectly personified. I'm going to say instead, a movie by a filmmaker who I am not a huge fan of in general, but this film is one of my favorites. It's Les Bonheurs by Agnès Varda.
Great
it's
movie.
A beautiful film. Very simple story of a guy who is married with kids and just has a fling with another beautiful woman. And it's just kind of the story of him going back and forth between these two women and being perfectly content with this relationship, this setup where he's, you know, cheating on his wife. But like when he's with his wife, he is so completely in love with her and his children and having a, you know, a fully functional relationship with them. And then when he switches over to this other woman, he has this amazing relationship with them. And the movie kind of becomes about how he can possibly sustain this balance of these two different worlds that he's living in. That's available through
Criterion.
It's
such a gorgeous looking movie.
Yeah.
So gorgeous. Oh, that movie, gorgeous. Every single frame is lovely to look at. I think it's Agnes Varda's best film.
Oh, without a doubt for me. I mean, she's great, but I'm just not personally a gigantic fan of her, but I love this movie, and it's available in the Agnes Varda set through Criterion. So
you guys want to plug your picks?
Are you guys not
going to
have your own 65 picks?
We do that the next episode.
Gotcha.
For the non-curse solo one.
Well, we'll have to listen.
Spoiler alert.
We'll have to listen, won't we?
Yeah. Spoiler alert, I'll have a Russ Meyer movie in there, but which one? There are a couple.
Frankie Avalon's not in a Russ Meyer movie?
I don't, yeah.
Breasts are not big enough.
Spoiler alert for my picks, I already mentioned them off the podcast.
ThePinkSmoke.com is a website that we run. And we have a theme month. Should we announce that coming up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In April, we are doing all month long. It's Jacques Tourneur month at the Pink Smoke. So we have a bunch of articles and some podcasts and a bunch of stuff coming up. So if you like cat people, if you like Berlin Express, if you like... Now I'm caught up on all of his non-famous movies. Out of the Past. I Walked with a Zombie.
Curse the Demon.
Curse of the Demon. Great filmmaker who we're excited to talk about in depth. And also we have a Patreon. We actually have a podcast called the Pink Smoke Podcast, which is a Patreon subscriber only podcast. If you subscribe to the Pink Smoke for any amount, you get this monthly podcast every month. We've actually been doing two a month because they're so easy and so fun to do, where we discuss a new movie with a filmmaker or writer or critic of some kind. We just had Outlaw Vern, the film critic, his first podcast appearance ever, discussing Eli Roth's Death Wish. We had the writer of the Winchester House movie on, discussing that film. And we have a lot of interesting people. We have the filmmaker Alan Cordell coming up to talk about Soderbergh's new movie. We're doing it all, but you should subscribe to the Patreon because our Patreon goes towards supporting the writers on our site. Anybody who writes for our site now gets paid. We don't ask for anybody to write for just the joy and exposure of it, and we try and pay competitive rates. So that's what your Patreon money goes towards. You get this podcast to listen to, and you make sure writers get paid.
Yeah, I like the sound of that. Writing for free / exposure is...
It's an evil scam, and you're morally corrupt if you're a website that's engaging in it. And you should be ashamed of yourself, ashamed of the emptiness of your politics, ashamed of the emptiness of your life. You have a rotten soul. Even your nose is rotten. You can't smell how rotten your soul is.
But Joel, you got a space pod. You're sending people into space.
What?
Aren't you sending people into space?
We're specifically not sending anyone into space. We don't want anyone to go there. Please don't send me into outer space.
Fine.
It's a science fiction and fantasy podcast I do once a week with my co-hosts Sarah and Aaron, where we talk about different science fiction and fantasy movies. This month, and I don't know when this episode is going to release, but most recently we were talking about the...
on Monday.
Well, there was another episode we recorded recently. I don't know when that one's coming out.
Either
way, March is Star Trek Next Generation month, where we're going through the four Next Generation movies one at a time. We just finished First Contact, which was excellent, and
that's a good episode.
Chronologically, I think that means we've only got movies to look forward to from here on.
Yeah, two real winners.
If you want me to talk about the one with the space dune buggy, I am absolutely up for that.
Man, you...
Where Picard's like, we got the hot new technology. It's going to blow your mind. It's a space dune buggy.
Patrick Stewart's a fan of off-roading, so they worked it into the script.
You guys are both welcome anytime you want to be on.
I would love to go to space with Joel. I just watched the whole Gamera series, which evolves into space travel stories.
Ah, yeah. We got to get into that kind of stuff anyways.
If there's one thing I can recommend your listeners to do, go read Roger Ebert's review of Gamera, where he makes a very convincing case that Gamera is powered by farts. I kid you not that it is the farting space turtle review you did not know you wanted to read.
I have a Japanese movie blog called Jailhouse 701, Japanese cult cinema. I am halfway through the Battles Without Honor and Humanity series.
Yeah.
It is a great
so
series.
So awesome. So fucking good.
So many characters to keep
But at least he slows down to differentiate between them. Isn't that...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he shows a little chyron of like who they are, which is great. I'm going through that series. I have two left, and... After that, I'm going to do Belladonna of Sadness, which I've seen before, and has Nakadai as the voice of the devil, who is he's like a penis monster who has sex with a woman and thinks her a witch. It's a interesting little anime erotic thing. I recommend watching Belladonna of Sadness, and then I will be on the FlixWise podcast with Martin Kessler in April,
right
talking
on.
About the
right on. Martin's great.
He's going to come on here for Dodeskaden in a few months or so. But I will go on his podcast talking about the Chadean movie Durat, which is about a teen boy who tracks down his dad's killer.
If you want to get into Martin's good graces. Keep comparing it to Predator 2. You will win him over in 2 seconds. Say, this is like a later Resident Evil movie, and he will be... Mwah.
I was on Grindbin episode 74 talking about Coonskin, not my favorite movie, but the movie I'm most obsessed with, because it's Coonskin and it's something. And I did a review on the Grindbin website on it that you should read.
It's kind of like the Ralph Bakshi version of Belladonna of Sadness.
Yeah, that's quite a movie.
Yeah, whatever it is, it's something.
And so that's it for me. And you can listen to the tag for email, Twitter, all that stuff. Hashtag ThugLife, Nakadai Forever. Hashtag Chipmunk Cheeks, Joe Shishido Forever. You know the stuff.
Hashtag Joe. Save Jobo.
What?
Joel?
No.
Got anything?
No.
No? Okay.
Nah.
You seem tired.
I had to get it.
Tired of not talking about Ghosts of Mars.
That's right.
All right. See you next episode.
Thanks for having us on. This is always fun when I come
on
here. Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah.
I hope I was not terrible.
Yeah, thank you. This is lots of fun.
See you next episode for the film An Innocent Witch by Gosho, not Gosha.
Yeah, I've never heard of it. I'm excited to hear that.
Gosha. He's great.
And that's it. So see you in 2 weeks.
Hey.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podient. Thank you for listening.